which directly affect world affairs. Your host, research specialist Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae Brussel again. And we have about 45 minutes to share a lot of events that are taking place in the world today. For the people who have been listening to me a long time on KLRB, almost 2 years next month, we talk about political assassinations, take the format of the news each week, and show it how it pertains to the past political assassinations, which are not a dead issue. They're just coming to life, back to life in America today. There's been a suppression of news, the truth about political assassinations in this country. But the truth is coming out. It will be revealed as the Watergate story keeps unfolding. I refer it as the biggest day of American history outside the invasion of the beachhead at Normandy. The tide of fascism has been stopped. We're going to uncover a lot of truths, and a lot of people are going to be removed from office, and some will go to jail. And the important thing is that their method of operation will be revealed, and we'll get some changes. Last week I talked about some of the good things that have been happening, and people like that, I understand, in the tide of American history, the effect of the Watergate. If it's taking the headlines now every day and opening the news, radio, television, broadcast, it has to have some meaning to us in our lives. And what is the meaning? I'm going to try each week to take the meaning of the news as it comes out and show how it's going to benefit all of us as this thing keeps unfolding, and try to summarize some of the events that are taking place, because they are gigantic every hour now as they unfold, and you can watch. It's a view of your country's operations, your hidden government, your secret government, your intelligence government, being disrobed in front of you. If you watch how they operate, you'll know how to protect yourself from operatives, provocateurs, imposters, people that would overthrow the American system of government, the electoral system. You can watch it all, their aliases, their false passports, their secret money, their secret funding, their abuse of the Justice Department. The country is made up of 50% Democrats, 50% Republicans. Not exactly, there's some other parties, but Kennedy won by 51% in 1960. That he was murdered, and the majority never had a person that represented them again. The government was overthrown in Dallas in 1963. It's going to get back to its feet. It almost never had a chance of recovering from that coup d'etat, but now it looks like we're on our way back. The president admitted this week that the espionage operations came from the White House. We have a loss of confidence. Surely there should be a loss of confidence in the entire presidency. Everyone in his cabinet is involved. Mr. Haldeman has stepped down. Now the Attorney General has said, I can't investigate the Watergate case. He should be out. He should be tried for perjury in the ITT hearings. Richard Klein, it should be out of office. If he can't investigate one thing, he can't investigate another. If these are his close friends and they put him in office and he hid the truth from the American people, the Justice Department represents every political party, not just Richard Nixon's party, and he should not only step down, he should be removed from office. In my article in The Realist, that in the local community there at the Thunderbird bookstore, I talk about how people in the Nixon administration just stepping down. None have been arrested yet. The way they escaped, like Will Wilson, who is the assistant attorney general in charge of criminal division, went off to Texas when he was involved in the Texas stock scandal. They stepped down. It's not enough to step down. We have to really see that these people lose control of the positions they had as espionage agents. But we have Mr. Haldeman stepping down. The press secretary, the White House press secretary, used his full denials and accusations, particularly the Washington Post this last summer. He accused them of being political and trying to expose the Watergate. Mr. Ziegler said yesterday that, or this week, that everything he said up to the present time is inoperative right now. That's an intelligence agency term. What he should say, translated, means everything I said was a lie until today, and it's a lie tomorrow, and I've been a liar ever since I've been in office. I can't talk straight, because if I told you the truth, it would shake this country to its foundations. That's translated for everything I said up to the present is inoperative. Now, in Germany, there was a building that burnt down, the Reichstag, and a servant working in the building ran to Goebbels and Goering and said, "The Reichstag is burning, quick, get the radicals." And the Reichstag was burning. And out came a list that Himmler and Goebbels had made of all the radicals that they were to line up and get rid of after they had set their own Reichstag fire, and they knew who to round up and take to jail, and the excuse of taking them was the Reichstag fire. In the United States in 1968, the shooting of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy brought our Reichstag to the fore in the sense of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, the LEAA. That was a thing that was set up by John Mitchell, the Attorney General, and Robert Martin, the Assistant Attorney General, and Mr. Leonard in the Justice Department to round up all the radicals and turn this country against its own citizens, its students, minority political leaders. And the LEAA in 1968 was formed to begin drastic street surveillance, data banks, politicizing of your police departments, lobotomies they were getting ready to do, and they're doing the electric shock treatment on prisoners and isolating the political prisoners and photographing homes through homes and down entire streets. San Jose and certain sections are photographed as tests to see how they can photograph whole neighborhoods at one time. And in 69, $1.75 billion was put into police departments for the LEAA. I'm mentioning these things now in return of the Watergate because, as you see, John Mitchell, who helped write the crime bill in Washington in 1970, the no-knock, where you come in the house and arrest or just enter without any reason, or your preventive detention, where you can be locked up without committing a crime and no bail to get out, your grand jury inquisitions, all of these repressions to handle the anti-war protesters, the minority people, the youth, anybody who didn't like the Nixon administration, who was anti-establishment, all the funding, all the laws, all the money was set up to round up any opposition. It was exactly like the Reichstag. And the man that designed this, the Attorney General, John Mitchell, has been named now as being part of the espionage operation. Marie Stand Safe, Secretary of Commerce, had secret fundings that could have gone up to many millions of dollars, and these were crisp $100 bills we're going to go into in a little while. You had your Attorney General in a two-party system in the United States, and as I said, the Peace and Freedom, the Communist Party, and the smaller parties, but here he represented supposedly the people of the United States, and he sat in the Justice Department while he was in the Justice Department, not when he moved to the committee in the spring, funding operations to sabotage the Democratic Party, working for Nixon's campaign, raising money or siphoning money, which still has to be, we have to know the source of it. Did it come from our Central Intelligence Agency? The taxes that you pay this week and the money that you earn, does it go to pay to sabotage yourself? They are still not sure where these crisp $100 bills in consecutive order are coming from. The Attorney General sat there. He was sabotaging the entire Democratic process. He was charged or suggested he's going to be brought in on concealing conspiracies. He's been handing money out to tell the people not to talk, which is a criminal act. That is illegal and criminal. The entire bugging operation was a criminal act. And stopping justice, arranging to buy silence, will bring a criminal indictment. John Mitchell will probably could be brought in for perjury in the ITT case, and the settlement of the Vesco case with the Security Exchange Commission is being investigated now. Now, that was the head of the Justice Department, and with him was Robert Mardian, Assistant Attorney General. Now, Fred LaRue's name is in the news a lot tonight. I'll give you a little rundown on him in a minute, but he worked with Robert Mardian. The Assistant Attorney General was out in California with Patrick Gray and John Mitchell and Fred LaRue and the whole espionage team. He was in Texas, where he was the chief fundraiser for the money that went to Mexico that helped pay for part of the Watergate operation. And he was in the office with Fred LaRue to destroy the records that would show where their contacts came from and their money. The Assistant Attorney General. There's a crisis in our entire Justice Department. Mr. Dean, John Dean, was in the Justice Department, an important position before he became the president's his White House lawyer. Herbert Kalmbach is his personal lawyer. All of these people have been in office, I have said for a long, long time, illegally, because the power was usurped through the act of murder. This administration, the murder of Robert Kennedy, or the attempted murder of George Wallace, that was part of the Southern strategy that will be traced in time. We have our attorney general, our assistant attorney general, the president's lawyer, all of them involved. These are the important things about the Watergate. As these names fall in on the news, many people wonder, well, who is Dean? Who is LaRue? They're very important because they made these repressive laws. The data banks, the surveillances, and the repressive prison laws, they have been bringing down a lot of unfair legal loopholes to lock up people that they considered radical, that they had created a situation like the Reichstag all over this country with their phony conspiracy trials, and have these people locked in jail now 1, 2, 3 more years, some for many years. Are locked up in prison and have to be removed from prison and working on the evidence that the people who framed them to get in the first place were there because of they had usurped the power and were acting under ways that were not legal at the time they even made these laws or were funding this money to our police department. Now, John Mitchell is a person that very few people would have believed a year ago was going to be arrested or indicted or wearing his striped suit. And a lot of people don't know his background or where John Mitchell came from. In the article I did on The Realist, I mentioned that Richard Nixon was an espionage agent. I believed he was set up by the aerospace people, the Bank of America, that he is not a standard Republican in the actual sense of the word. And in connecting Richard Nixon, he was meant to be the president, and he was contacted when he lost the election in California. He went back east to the office of John Mitchell. Now, John Mitchell was not a Republican. He was an independent. Most of his life, he wasn't even registered, but he knew a lot of political people. And very many of our espionage agents are not Republican or Democrat. John Mitchell didn't know Nixon all the years that Nixon was vice president, supposedly the Republican. And Mitchell had important contacts in Florida. But in 1967, Mitchell and Nixon teamed up in a law office in New York, and Mitchell came to Washington, this in 1968, when we were getting ready for the next election. He spoke to 15 Republicans in the House of Representatives, and they were the nucleus of the group that would be for Nixon in Congress. And this is what he said. He said the following. He said, "My name is John Mitchell. I'm senior partner in the Nixon firm. I am worth more in legal business than any other partner." He's worried about the money. "I am manager of the Nixon campaign. You may believe that nobody can manage a Nixon campaign, but I'm going to manage this one. You are all important men. You will want to talk to me about your states. You will not be able to reach me, at least at the time when you want me. And you're not to go to Richard Nixon." The Republican governors and key figures were not to go to Richard Nixon. He said, "You're to talk to Mitchell. You won't be able to reach me, not when you want me, but I will talk to you when I can. And don't get sore about it. We'll get along just fine. We can win the election. Thank you very much." And with that, he left Washington, went back to New York, and he began to manage Richard Nixon's campaign. Well, John Mitchell is he's 59 years old and had a lot of contacts. He was the lawyer of John Rockefeller in New York City, and he took over Richard Nixon as his protege. His law firm has been known for a lot. It represents a lot of contracts for the government, drug firms, and cases that were settled out of court used Mitchell's law firm. His connections were very, his politics and his private law practice were so intermingled that he could pick up the phone and settle cases for people. It was hard to separate it from contributions to the committee to his legal practice, because he incorporated so much money into the committee re-elect Nixon and then into his own law firm that kept developing. Like he said, he knows the money people, and he could build up this very important law firm. But he was a very close intimate, John Mitchell, of CIA Richard Helms, who's the chief of the covert operations, the clandestine operations of the CIA. He was a close personal friend of his. He read daily briefings from the CIA. He belonged to the super secret group that got briefings every 24 hours. He was a member of the Nixon's National Security Council. It screens all covert actions, and he was a strong advocate of national security and wiretap. So John Mitchell was more of an espionage agent, and we were talking about an espionage operation, than he is a Republican. He wasn't registered. He was independent for many, many years, but he was an espionage agent who has worked with Richard Helms. And this explains Eugenio Martinez, who was arrested at the Watergate, was on the payroll at the CIA at the time he was arrested. The CIA gave the name of the locksmith in Miami to Mr. Hunt and Mr. Liddy. That came out this week for their operations. It gave Mr. Howard Hunt his aliases and his disguises. And there's these $100 bills in consecutive order, numerical order. And Senator Mathias was asking this week, where does that come from? Because was our government funding this whole massive operation to sabotage the country? James McCord was 21 years with the CIA, had been in Russia the same time Oswald was, and worked with Alan Dulles in the U-2 flight. He was with the CIA until he worked for John Mitchell. He had no other client or job in that interim. Mr. Sturgis and Barker and Gonzalez, who were arrested at the Watergate, were CIA. I mention all this because as the story unfolds, I'm trying to point out for many people who I've said all along that these political assassinations were part of a central intelligence agency plot that controlled our electoral process since 1960. And John Mitchell fits more into the profile of the agent, and he's been arrested with the others. And as you watch the news unfold, try to think of it as a layer of not Republican and Democrat, but that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have both been sabotaged by intelligence agencies that have infiltrated both parties to keep control of the government. Now, there's one dialogue conspiracy talks about the assassinations of the evidence of conspiracy that killed Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King or John Kennedy or many, many deaths. But also related to these deaths are people that work with them or who have evidence to expose the truth. And a man was murdered last week. I want to talk about him because these people cannot be forgotten. They are soldiers out there trying to tell you the truth. If I say we're in a civil war, which is what I'm writing about now, and it is a battle, there are casualties. And a man that was killed last week, his name is Walter Emerson. And maybe you wouldn't even know about him. The Associated Press, the United Press, doesn't talk about it. But Walter Emerson is a man who produced a movie that was about to come out. It'll be coming out soon, called The Second Gun. The movie was supposed to come out before the elections, but it was held up. The Second Gun is the story of the murder of Robert Kennedy. And it's based on the evidence that Theodore Chirac worked on, that Sirhan did not kill Robert Kennedy. And Mr. Emerson put up the money to make the movie. Gerald Alcorn was a producer of the movie, the director. I met him last summer when I was in L.A., and the movie was just about ready to come out. Gerald Alcorn, the Frenchman, did the directing of the movie, The Second Gun. And Walter Emerson financed the movie. He was getting intimidation calls on the phone. They shot into his shop. He has a dress design shop. He had knowledge where he makes clothes for the movie studios and for movie stars for the various sets. He's a costume designer. He put up the money for the movie, and he got phone calls, stay out of the Chirac business or we're going to get you and your family or your mother. Well, he kept on making the movie, and the movie was completed, and he was served papers on a phony prosecution charge. They were going to arrest him, and there were his signatures on some papers, which he had not signed, and he was going to get arrested with a criminal offense for signing these papers that he had actually no part of doing. And he received a phone call that said his case would be dropped from the prosecution if he'd stay out of the Bobby Kennedy affair and stop financing the murder. He refused to stop, He went to court. The court found him guilty. His name was forged on the papers. He walked out of the court, and a man walked up to him and said, "You asked for it, and now you're going to get it." And he put a gun in his stomach and shot him and killed him. So Walter Emerson was killed last week. The producer, the man who put up the money for the movie, The Second Gun, that shows you the position the person was in and who killed Robert Kennedy in the Ambassador Hotel. Now, Kathy Fulmer, one of the girls that was in the Ambassador that night, was murdered. That was the girl in the polka dot dress who said, "We killed Kennedy," and ran out. She was murdered. And another man, Mr. Krasny, associated with that death, was arrested. And Mr. Gonzalez, who was a friend of Sirhan's, was arrested, and he was found hanging. He's dead. And Mr. Harper, the pathologist from Pasadena, well-known, worldwide recognized pathologist who lives in Pasadena, was shot at recently. And Betty Dreyer, the wife of Alex Dreyer, he writes an article down in LA on assassinations and helped with Theodore Chirac with the movie. She was abducted and stabbed and kidnapped. And Carl Uecker, the man in the Ambassador Hotel who was one of the witnesses standing with Sirhan, who said he was never in a position to kill Robert Kennedy, has left the country. But it's a very sad day to talk about Walter Emerson, and they did kill him. They said they would, and they killed him. I'm going to talk about a little bit about a case in San Francisco, which is coming up, because when I began the show to talk about the Justice Department, the Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General, the whole system of justice is so perverted now that I hope as the Watergate unfolds, we'll be able to take it right down to our local communities. It'll go from Washington to California and then to our investigation of those grand juries that Mr. Mardian set up, and then down to the district attorney's office and find out why these people are hell-bent on getting prosecutions of innocent people. It's become an election gimmick to pick up people and get a record. There's a case up in Santa Cruz that's been going on in Mr. Peter Chang's territory with this particular fellow. His name is Fox. Evidence was planted against him. He's wanted on a charge where he was set up and the provocateur skipped town. The witness that would prove his innocence was murdered. That Cindy Shell, Cindy Shell was murdered. And this boy's been set up as a patsy for the law enforcement to get more money. They say, well, we've got this big crime thing going, and they set up youth. And the youth are always the people that are involved in peace marches or protests, and evidence is planted against them. Well, along those lines is the story that took a lot of attention, the Examiner did this week, about a boy in Chinatown. J. Edgar Hoover was out with his divide and conquer policy to set up provocateurs when he was still alive in Chinatown. And there was a boy named Joe Fong, F-O-N-G, who was taken and put in jail for a lifetime sentence in the state prison, found guilty of assault with deadly weapons and conspiracy to commit murder in connection with a 1972 shootout in Chinatown. Joe Fong was put into jail. Now, a new lawyer has taken his case, a Mr. Ryan. And he came up with evidence that in the course of the trial, a confession of the entire shootout was made by a boy named Clifton Wong. And he testified that neither Joe Fong nor David, there was another fellow in the car that was driving the car, Paul Liu, that neither one of them knew about the shooting. There were three boys in a car. One of them saw a rival gang, and he took out his gun, a .45 automatic, and fired into another car. Well, right after the firing, three were picked up. Clifton Wong was picked up, and Joe Fong and the person who was driving the car, Paul Liu, were picked up. And in the course of the investigation, the person who shot the gun said, "I want to tell what happened. I did it myself. The others weren't involved at all." And the assistant district attorney in San Francisco by the name of Pierre Merle made a bargain with him, and he said, "Look, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you don't clear the other person, if you just keep quiet, I'll let you proceed as a juvenile. Otherwise, I'll charge you as an adult, and then the penalty is greater." And he made a deal for him that he would change the charges and try him as an adult if he told the truth. Now, the assistant district attorney was hell-bent on prosecuting another totally innocent boy and sent him to jail. And the assistant district attorney made this deal with this particular young man that if you don't tell the jury or the judge what happened, don't clear the other fellow, and I'll give you a lighter charge. So Clifton Wong went before a grand jury, and he told them the truth. He wanted to tell the truth, and he told them the actual truth was that he was the only one who shot, and that nobody else shot. And he testified at the trial, and he had this trial under oath in the juvenile court proceedings, that he was the only one who shot the out of the car. And this testimony was willfully suppressed. The evidence was willfully suppressed by the prosecuting attorney, and they prosecuted another boy, Joe Fong, and sent him to San Quentin, sent him to jail on a lifetime, serving lifetime in a state prison. Now, it's just lucky that Joe Fong has an attorney, and the San Francisco Chronicle began to do investigative work and found out that this particular man, one of them, was sent away totally innocent. And this brings up the problem. Why did the attorney generals or the district attorneys have on their minds to get a prosecution when a person is totally innocent? I don't know how they can live with their conscience at night. I don't know why they do it. What gets into their head to have to prosecute? Well, one of the reasons they have to prosecute, they have to get more money for their neighborhoods and get more police equipment from LEAA. They have to show what good prosecutors they are during the election year. And they are sending perfectly innocent men to our prisons, and the evidence exists that they did not do what they were accused of doing. Well, as we see the breakdown of the Justice Department with the Attorney General, the district attorneys, the prosecutors, the grand jury system, as it all falls apart, we have to think of ways to build it up again. What are private citizens going to do? And I think of examples like that Kitty Hawk example, the Navy carrier, the ship, the riots. And we talked on this on other programs where 22 blacks were charged with violence and starting a riot and only one white man. Well, the Civil Liberties Union got their own investigator, and he put on a bugging device, a wiring device, went to a bar, talked to one of the men who had helped prosecute the blacks in the Navy. The man admitted that he had lied in court. He admitted he was a racist and that the thing was rigged. Well, the offshoot of that was that the Navy has dropped the charges on all the men, and they've hushed it up. And they just dropped all the charges, let them out of the brig, no punishments and so forth, and they don't want to talk about the Kitty Hawk anymore. What if one private citizen didn't track down the man who was the witness for the prosecution? You could get 10 or 20 men spending 10 or 12 or 20 years of their life in jail over absolutely nothing if one conscientious person didn't follow through and help those lives. You have the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein won an award this week for their best journalism. In the Washington Post, carrying the Watergate, what if those men didn't investigate all summer and keep working? Where was the news media? Everybody else was satisfied to cover up all that scandal that was festering in Washington and pretend it didn't happen. Ron Ziegler called those men all kinds of names, and he said this summer, "This is a political effort by the Washington Post, well conceived and coordinated with the aim of discrediting the administration." The acts of the administration discredited themselves. The Washington Post was only trying to find out what really happened. So it was two men, just Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who alone, almost alone, carried the entire Watergate from the time of the arrest to keep America informed. Now, the San Francisco Chronicle has been doing the investigative work to clear Joe Fong. But after they clear Joe Fong, what about all the other men that are locked up? You see, if somebody takes, a particular lawyer takes one person, or an investigative agency helps one person, that's far out. But we have to apply it to all the other people that are locked up that don't have someone at bat for them. And what are we going to do about them? How are we going to organize to get them together? Angela Davis this week came out. She's starting an organization with Reverend Abernathy and Congressman Conyers from Michigan to raise defense money for men in the adjustment center in the prisons. Those are political prisoners that are brutalized and beaten and threatened to be killed just daily. And they're going to get a group going. The first meeting will be May in Illinois. And I think with the Watergate evidence of the way the criminals have run the Justice Department, they'll have more leverage to get the men out of the adjustment centers if they can show the conspiracies to place them there in the first place that operated against them. So you have people speaking up now. You have Mr. Ellsberg today, and he was testifying on why he revealed the Pentagon Papers, and he is charged that America is responsible for violating the Geneva Accord and the Nuremberg agreements. Well, we know we broke the Geneva Accord, and he talks about the Nuremberg agreements. We are the lawbreakers, we who have allowed the government to do these things. He isn't the lawbreaker if he wants to prove that we sat down with all these nations and came by certain agreements, and we've broken every single one of them. Ellsberg said today, the evidence appears to be that we hired an army for Diem that would imprison and harass anyone that wanted to abide by the Geneva Agreement for free election. We hired an army for Diem that would put anybody in jail that abided by the agreement that we signed in 1956. Then Ellsberg said under the Nuremberg principles, that would be a crime against peace. And the other evidence I'm talking about on the battlefield is not my lie, but the high-level Washington planning in the name of the evidence used at Nuremberg. Namely, he said the overthrow and the assassination of a leader of a friendly country like Diem. He said segments of the Pentagon Papers read to the jurors show that U.S. agents helped plan a 63 coup, 1963, against South Vietnam President Diem, who was assassinated. When I started at KLRB 2 years ago, we started with the Pentagon Papers, and the very first show was the fact that the American Army and Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge and Ellsworth Bunker and all the men working with Diem were planning his overthrow, his coup, and had the full knowledge of what was taking place, and the man was killed just prior to the Kennedy assassination, just a month earlier. And here was supposedly a friendly person, an ally, and Ellsberg is saying we broke the Geneva Accord, we put anyone in jail who abided by it. We broke the Versailles Treaty by rearming Germany, and we broke the Nuremberg Agreement by a military coup of our own ally. Now, in the Realist article, which I keep referring to all the time, the one on why was Martha Mitchell kidnapped, I mentioned that the whole Watergate affair was a government plan to keep in power certain particular persons that no person like Ted Kennedy or Governor Wallace even could win the election if he could get enough votes. There's nobody opposing Richard Nixon that was going to be allowed to run for election and live. And every day or every few days, there's evidence coming in on the CIA involvement in the Watergate. I call the CIA involvement because those crisp, consecutive $100,000 bills, $100 bills do come right from the federal mint, no matter how you slice it. This isn't picked up by election donations. These consecutive dollars have to come from the mint. And the CIA supplied the locksmith. This was in the Jack Anderson columns today down in Miami. They gave the name of the locksmith to break in the Democratic headquarters. Well, at the time Bobby Kennedy was killed, Sirhan Sirhan had the keys to a car that the cook had there and keys to hotel rooms. He had a locksmith working for him. And he had $400 in consecutive orders in his pocket. And there was a locksmith. The CIA provided the aliases for Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy. And they did something else, which when we go into security or the life of Richard Nixon, because this is involved with the CIA operations that I say are covert, involved political assassinations, they not only supplied false documents and passports and names and consecutive $100 bills, but the Secret Service had provided Mr. Liddy, G. Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt with keys to the White House, their locksmith. The Secret Service, they had keys to the White House. And Mr. Hunt had a gun in his desk. He had a walkie-talkie that connected James McCord. Mr. Dean of the White House, who was just named today, who's stepping down, the president's attorney in the White House, took from his desk a notebook with numbers of people to call, and we don't know yet what names and numbers Mr. Hunt had in the White House. Mr. Liddy, it turns out, this week had a key, his own special key to the White House. Mr. Liddy carried an attaché case with nothing in it but a towel and a weapon, a gun in that case. And Mr. Fred LaRue, who's been named today, who had an apartment at the Watergate Hotel where $350,000 was taken from Mr. Haldeman in the White House over to the Watergate, carried over there by Mr. Magruder. Fred LaRue had a weapon that he carried and gave to Mr. Baldwin on the airplanes when he escorted Martha Mitchell around. And he wasn't supposed to be carrying that, and he assured him, that's all right. Your friend, the former attorney generals, you can carry that weapon on the plane. These men, each of them was armed, were in and out of the White House all the time, had desks there, keys there. And this is the time of the season we were trying to keep Richard Nixon alive, and there was reason to believe that he was going to be killed based on the Lewis Tapkwood allegations. And a man named Andrew Topping was arrested. He had an appointment to go in the White House to see the president between the time that the president was nominated and the time he took the oath of office. And we still don't know yet if Andrew Topping's money that he paid for various assassins to help him was not connected to the Watergate. There's silence on that. You might write to the Senate Judiciary and ask them if you want more on Mr. Andrew Topping. Andrew Topping, write to the members of the Judiciary and get the lowdown about why they hushed up that assassination attempt, because I think it's going to be tied into the Watergate, and every week new things are breaking, so watch for that and see what happens. But these men had keys to the White House, and I think it's a very dangerous situation. The Vesco name you're going to see in the news for the next few weeks. Vesco is a firm that's being investigated by the Security Exchange Commission. This involves Richard Nixon's brothers. A donation was given to the committee to reelect the president of $200,000. And Richard Nixon's brother had contact with the party's Donald Nixon. It helped deliver that money to the committee to reelect the president. He called to find out whether they wanted in cash or whether they wanted in a check. And Mr. Nixon's Edward Nixon, 42 years old, the president's younger brother, flew by helicopter from New York to Vesco's headquarters in New York to discuss the contribution, whether it should be cash. And they told him that Nixon verified that it was to be in the cash. That's the way they wanted it. And then the cash was taken into that secret cash fund for intelligence gathering that went into Maurice Stans' safe in Washington, that famous safe. They were $100 bills in a black attaché case. And the arrangements were set up by Donald Nixon, the brother of Richard Nixon. A Mr. Cherney hired a private detective to help him investigate the chain of command about where this money would be and how it would be turned over. And Mr. Vesco is a prominent financier. He was wanted in Switzerland for a swindle of the New York Security Exchange Commission of a suit of $224 million taken from mutual funds. He's been down to Costa Rica investing that money lately. I read in the paper this morning, they saw some millions pouring in. They said, oh, that must be Vesco money. People are catching on to it, but it's very important. This lawsuit that's happening now that's involving 19 persons and 21 corporations, it involves a swindle of $224 million. And when they wanted help from the Justice Department and they wanted John Mitchell to put in a word at the Security Exchange Commission, he did this for them. John Mitchell did it, but then he did it for $200,000 cash. And it was Donald Nixon that took care of the cash transactions, the money that went into Mr. Vesco's suitcase. So the Nixon brothers and nephew are involved in that, and that gets pretty touchy. Now I'm going on to one more subject, because a lot of people may want to know about the investigation of who's going to be investigating the Watergate for the Senate, and I brought the names of one or two men that are involved in the investigation to give you an background of what it's going to be like, because it's going to be extensive and it's going to go on for a long, long time. Before I go into the sleuth on the Watergate, I did want to mention that Martha Mitchell is very anxious to talk. She's been subpoenaed by Bernard Fencerwell to talk to the grand jury. She's been wanting to talk for a long time about what happened. She doesn't want her husband to take the rap for anybody. Well, there's no one over her husband except Mr. Rockefeller and Mr. Nixon. So it'll be interesting what she tells the grand jury. But Sam Ervin's committee was hesitant to have her because she's a woman. They put her down. They're trying to make out that she's crazy again. She's afraid that they really are very much afraid to have her tell what happened because she was out in California, and there was Patrick Gray, an FBI man, in the room with her when she was thrown through a glass window and her hand had stitches, and Herbert Kalmbach took her to the hospital, the president's personal attorney, and she said there were FBI men in the room. And Patrick Gray was out there in California, and Patrick Gray is a close friend of Senator Eastland, who's on the Judiciary Committee. Robert Mardian was in California, and Mr. Colson and Hunt and Liddy. They're all afraid of Martha. The committee, the Senate probe, says we'll go into this matter, we'll go into that, but they're really afraid of Martha Mitchell because she will tell a lot. And when she tells it, she's going to involve, she talked about the cops and robbers game, she's going to involve Steve King. You see, she'll bring in many of the top operatives that are still in positions that haven't been smoked out yet, like Steve King was the guy who threw her through the glass and took the phone off the wall, and then when they came back to Washington, he was promoted to the chief of security. And he has a very important position right now in Washington, a key position. So if she mentions these people, then they have to call them. She says, why weren't they arrested? So they're avoiding Martha. She knows the whole top echelon because she was the attorney general's wife, and she was assaulted, brutalized. Her John is going to jail, and they're afraid of her because women play a different game. It's a little more honest. I think she'll tell more. The men tell a little bit, and they protect themselves and let a little bit drip out at a time. If she comes before the committee, she'll really lay it on the line. The New York Times, April the 9th, 1973, has an article on the sleuth on the Watergate. We only have about 2 minutes, so I can't go into a lot of it. But it's a background of the men who are going to be investigating the case. And the important thing, they're going to have a staff of maybe 75 men or women, the largest of its kind since they investigated the labor rackets 15 years ago. Samuel Dash is the chief attorney for the investigation. And what he said, this is a quotation, this investigation will be the anatomy of a presidential election, an inquest that will range beyond the Watergate, beyond the criminal conduct, beyond the Republican Party, in a sweeping review of political ethics in the country today. Well, the article I did in The Realist said that it began by saying the Democrats, as well as the Republicans, are responsible for this mess. I've mentioned to a lot of people, this is not only a Republican exposure. Don't think it is for a minute. Mr. Humphrey was supported by the same people that put in Richard Nixon, and President Johnson worked with the same people that work with the Republicans in power. The Democratic Party on our own peninsula is 50% Republican spies and 50% Democrats. Most of the Democrats in town don't have anything to do with my Watergate research. The Republicans respond more to my radio talks into what I'm saying than the Democrats. The Democrat spies haven't been smoked out yet, and they're all scared. Well, the time is running out. We won't get too much into Dash. I want to give you a profile of him and Terry Lesner and Rogovin, the investigators. They say there's a staff of 75, but our time's running out. So what we'll do next week, I'll try and do a background of who's investigating, and it'll give you a preview of where we're going to go. And then you'll know how big the investigation is really going to become.